2019 and June 30th, 2019, you should have received either an email ballot, a postcard, or paper ballot. If you haven't, then fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members without access to the internet can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Vision Fest Promoters Arts for Arts fall season of free jazz music and art events begins September 6th at the Clemente Soto Velez Center with a poetic and musical tribute to poet Steve Cannon, including a performance of the Sun Ra Orchestra. The series runs through the fall with performances in Manhattan Community Gardens, the Weeksville Heritage Center, and over Columbus Day weekend in East Harlem. The full schedule's at artsforart.org. That's arts with an S for art.org.
It's 8 p.m. You're listening to WBAI New York. Time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Very good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hi there.
And returning to New York, Voltaire.
Hello.
How you doing?
Pretty good, thanks.
Well, as usual, we will be discussing high technology and encouraging people to get out there and take control of it and learn how to use things, learn how to be secure, and learn when you're being lied to. Kind of a grab action, take action, and just learn how to do these things, because it's so important. It's so important to be in control rather than be controlled. And there's a lot of things going on that I think we need to fill people in on. This is something I just found out about, actually. There's a plan by Trump to use Fitbit data to stop mass shootings. Did you know you could do that? Maybe you didn't. Well, you can, apparently, if you subscribe to his particular way of thinking. In the aftermath of yet another mass shooting in America, says Gizmodo, loved ones grieve. Gun control advocates call for common sense reforms, and politicians suggest new solutions that won't do anything about guns. These proposals frequently focus on mental health, but a new plan before the White House to monitor neurobehavior predictors of violence isn't just misguided, it's terrifyingly dystopian. Not my opinion, that's what they say at Gizmodo, but it's interesting. Now, last week, the Washington Post reported that the White House had been briefed on a plan to create an agency called HARPA. It's a healthcare counterpart to the Pentagon's research and development arm, DARPA, which is the precursor to the entire internet. Among other initiatives, this new agency would reportedly collect volunteer data from a suite of smart devices, including Apple Watches, Fitbits, Amazon Echoes, and Google Homes, in order to identify neurobehavioral signs of someone headed toward a violent explosive act. Now, just think about that for a second. Your Fitbit, how's your Fitbit going to know? Your Fitbits, your Echoes and Alexas and all that, and Google Home devices and your Apple Watches, they're all going to be watching you. and predicting when you're going to turn into somebody who's going to do something psychotic and violent and not very nice. And then it's going to tell somebody, and then action will be taken against you, maybe before you even know it. Now, according to the Washington Post, the Harper proposal was discussed with senior White House officials back in June of 2017. But now it's gained momentum after the mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton. Well, I'm not going to list them all. We don't have time. The latest version of the plan, reportedly submitted to the Trump administration this month, outlined the biometric project called Safe Home. Safe Home. And it stands for something, too. Stopping Aberrant Fatal Events. Wow. Who said that the Trump administration is not clever? Stopping aberrant fatal events and the home part, okay, by helping overcome mental extremes. That's amazing. A source told the newspaper that every time HARPA has been discussed in the White House, even up to the presidential level, it's been very well received. Now, you know, people say that the Trump administration is not interested in doing anything about gun violence. And here we see that, in fact, they are interested. They're interested in having our home devices, our personal assistants, watch us to make sure that we're not going to go off the deep end. And when we do, they'll be there to inform on us. Isn't that comforting?
I'm gonna have to think twice now that before the next time I listen to some death metal on my Amazon device.
Or you have a screaming fit in front of your Alexa device, you know, you start shouting incoherent things.
Right, which happens often.
Yeah,
you know, that's my household. But like the Fitbit thing too. I mean, this thing counts how many steps you take. How many steps does a killer take before they kill someone?
Well, how do you take the steps? You know, killers take steps in a different way. There's a way, you know,
like they sense you're walking angrily.
Mm-hmm. Well, like the TSA people, they can tell when somebody doesn't feel comfortable.
And yeah, your Fitbit can't see how brown your skin is.
Not yet.
Well, I imagine it. I mean, like recording kind of like blood pressure and things about anxiety, or maybe when you go to practice shooting or something, it knows a certain type of heart rate or something. And then, you know, maybe if you have that same physiological profile when you're entering someplace unusual, maybe that's, you know, something that triggers something to alert a human. Obviously, you know, an individual wouldn't be doing any one task in this. It would be some sort of software that then notifies authorities if something fits a certain profile. But my real takeaway, just hearing this, would like mainly be, what is the impact of overall like social control, because people are changing, as Rob said, changing their behavior. You know, what kind of subtle things will then start to happen? Like, you know, just basically because people don't want to trigger an alarm, like same thing with like fire, you know, doors that say this door alarmed or the fire alarms, people will avoid certain behaviors specifically. Mm-hmm. And what kind of greater forms of social control are exercised as a side effect?
We're talking about this now in 2019, but I guarantee that if this kind of thing is not shut down now, it will become reality, and we will wonder, well, what's so unusual about this 10 years from now when it's everywhere? And all it takes is for it to work once or twice, or be seen as working once or twice in stopping something from happening. It's very hard to say if you actually stop something that didn't happen from happening, but you can certainly claim credit for that.
Yeah, the reason part of why it's so scary is because currently you need to get the government has to get a warrant to get your Amazon data. We've had stories about that in the past, but now they're going to be asking for preemptively, like collecting it en masse, saying, "Oh, we need this to be able to predict things in the future."
Yeah, maybe not. Not gathering that from sources that are necessarily bound by sort of HIPAA and other health-related policies and regulations. If they can get it and sort of sidestep through commercial devices that people are sort of carrying around anyway, that data creating kind of a fingerprint of a psychological fingerprint of someone from sources that don't necessarily become like privileged or confidential health type information, I easily could see that gaining popularity. And then really, what is your psychological fingerprint today, or how can you be identified behaviorally from those different types of devices and recognized in a system that spots your profile as you move about or act in society?
Right, and you just touched on this. Information about your mental health is right now a very protected thing under the law. There are HIPAA laws. There are laws protecting the confidentiality of medical information about you.
But if you're wearing an Apple ankle bracelet, right. Yeah, who cares?
Right, but even then, so this is kind of an end run around the protections that that such things have, and especially mental health, especially these days, is still a very stigmatized thing. And people who have mental health concerns, or who may be having dark thoughts, or need to pursue some sort of mental health aid, it's very difficult to get people to take that step sometimes. And if people now have to worry about what lists they're going to get on as a result of seeking help for themselves, they're not going to seek the help. And then that's going to end badly.
Yeah, the policy then kind of masks the symptomatic people or individuals that are actually suffering and may need attention.
Right. Earlier this year, Andrew Cuomo said after one of the other damn mass shootings we had, that obviously one of the things we need to do, and I think he tweeted this, was put together a mental health database. And no, that is the worst idea.
Yeah, it's people with mental health issues are not the ones doing this. That has been proven over and over and over again. But, you know, we have to fall in line, and this is a wonderful technological way of dealing with the problem that is in our futures. Of course, predictably enough, there are naysayers. There are people who are against making things safer by having this kind of blacklist from our Alexa devices. Scientists, academics, people like that. Here's one. George David Annis. He's a deputy director of the Forensic Psychiatry Fellowship Program at SUNY Upstate Medical University. What does he know? He says, the proposed data collection goes beyond absurdity when they mention the desire to collect Fitbit data. I am unaware of any study linking walking too much and committing mass murder. As for the other technologies, what are these people expecting? Alexa, tell me the best way to kill a lot of people really quickly. Really? You know, when you say it like that, George, you kind of make it seem silly. You kind of make it seem like these people don't know what they're talking about. I don't see how that's helpful, but I am going to ask Alexa that tonight. I'm going to see just how upset I can get her.
Well, I think you've just asked a bunch of our listeners, Alexa's, this question. So if you get any interesting answers back, email us, oth@2600.com.
Emma Friedel is a doctoral candidate at Northeastern University specializing in mass murder. You can do that? You can specialize in mass murder as a doctoral candidate? My goodness.
You can be anything you want in America.
Well, if that's not inspiring, I don't know what is. But she said to Gizmodo, creating a watch list of citizens who most likely will never act violently based on their mental health is a very dangerous proposal with major ethical considerations. Doing so to predict the unpredictable is utterly absurd. Well, I guess there are the people that get things done, and then there are the scientists. And who are you going to believe?
Does anyone know, do Fitbits have microphones?
No.
I think Apple Watches have microphones, right? Do
yeah.
they?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So, but a Fitbit, not any new models or anything like that? Okay.
Actually, maybe the newer, smart ones might
I'm
have
curious.
Voice. I'm not sure.
You know, they're just kind of, oh, by the way, we're just going to add in, you know, this Bluetooth feature, well, you know, just kind of slip that in. But then all of a sudden, your conversation could be a part of what is harvested from that.
But Kyle, this is what people want. They want these things. We've talked about the Ring devices on doorbells, and now they are expanding that so that entire neighborhoods are sharing information as to who's coming up to your door, making it seem like everybody is out to get you, and that information is being shared with the police. And you're building up this surveillance network, but you're doing it yourself. You're not a victim of it. You're an instigator of it. And this is what people are expecting. And if you don't go along with it, suddenly you're the problem.
Also, that's the problem with regulating this kind of thing is you can put a law in place now when a Fitbit is just a fancy pedometer. But when more features get added down the line, that'll just get added to the database that these people are giving away access to now.
Yeah, I think it's a little disingenuous with some of the companies because like they then like go ahead and you're told that you're getting one type of device. And then, you know, at the outset and then, you know, a couple steps along, all of a sudden, you're a part of this big social surveillance experiment that they've signed on to. And I think that there's something unique about that that we have not seen with consumer electronics in the past, where they've features and they've these arrangements with bureaucracies and so on and so forth that are sort of just thrown in as a part of them, you know, being out there doing their business thing. And I don't know. I think that that's there's something false about that. There's something that's, like I said, disingenuous.
Yeah, I agree to Kyle's point that you shouldn't blame consumers for this. In fact, just when it comes to like things like smart TVs and stuff, you actually cannot buy a non-smart TV because they make extra money from being able to like sell the surveillance data. Same with when it comes to like Amazon Echoes and stuff like that.
Yeah, but consumers are buying these things. But if they stop buying these things, then it wouldn't.
But that's because nobody sells an. They have some convenience. I have some, but nobody sells like an off the shelf, easy to use version. I mean, you have open source products like Mycroft and Home AI, but those, but like it's. You can't walk into Best Buy and get an off the shelf privacy preserving one.
You'd be essentially buying like a computer monitor, right? At that point, if you wanted something so stripped down as like you know, you can't really get a screen that isn't a smart TV unless you're buying just a monitor, right?
The people who put together things like Tor and SecureDrop and all that. This is a great project, a consumer project.
They are
have
products like
a private television set that does not spy on you. And that is something that the average consumer would want, who doesn't want to be watched all the time, who wants to define the technology themselves.
Yeah, we're actually now in a state of affairs where, since most of these smart TVs run like some Linux derivative, people are jailbreaking and rooting their televisions, just as some people do with their phones, in order to gain full control over what it does and doesn't have permission to do.
Yeah, I think that's the prevalence of that is probably underestimated, and there's a lot of that kind of customization going on. I mean, we've seen it with a lot of little entertainment devices. I know some of the video players we've had that, you know, read different file formats and stuff, they like, you know, don't work. They basically stop working because you need to buy a new one, or the development team does not really want to continue that hardware. They want you to switch up and get another one. There's a lot of that kind of thing going on with devices that are essentially full-on computers, but they don't want to maintain it anymore. They don't want to write a firmware or a software for it that is that can kind of still fit the hardware requirements, but add new features that are going to kind of hook new consumers.
Yeah, you know, there's a great New Yorker cartoon from many decades ago where somebody is in line at a repair shop talking to the repair guy, who's telling them that you fix the problem by buying a new one. And that goes to Roku is what you were thinking of before, because we've got a Roku device and it just keeps freaking out and not working and kind of bricking itself. And I've looked up online.
We fed it as many SD cards as we could find.
It said you need
we
an SD card. It has an SD card.
We're trying to do everything.
Claims
we can
to be full, and then you have to start over again. And literally, the advice that you get is just buy another one.
Guess what the new Roku devices have in them.
Cameras?
Microphones.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Why? Even the remotes.
Why does my Roku need to hear me?
Well, that's another thing.
Because I want to sell the data.
By the way, Roku, it's an amazing device. It allows you to basically watch videos from all over the world through YouTube and other applications, and it's got a lot of good features, but it also has some bad features.
And the irony, I think, is that we're working with devices that are as configurable and can be repurposed, right? Like they're just running a particular set of software that someone developed when they were originally designing the product. But we're working with stuff that is way more reconfigurable and modifiable than many devices in the past. Most consumer electronics and electronic devices were something you would have to add hardware, you'd have to add various things, but you have devices that are incredibly affordable and, you know, full architectures for microcontrollers or small CPUs and are running like full copies of Linux, as Rob and Voltaire were saying. And that and it's just sort of a shame that in this moment, and that's why I think that prevalence of more projects where people are taking ownership. And, you know, if they find out there's a camera in their TV, or they find out there's, you know, a feature that, that really doesn't serve them, mm-hmm. that they're taking ownership in such a way that, you know, they can reconfigure and adapt it the way they're happy with as the owner.
And that is pretty much the theme of everything we encourage people to do is reconfigure things to your liking and have that ability to do that. Don't let somebody tell you you're not allowed to do this. We were watching a Blu-ray the other day, and it told us that, no, you can only watch this in a certain region. Of course, we have a region-free player, so you just enter the codes. But why should we have to do that? Why should we feel like we're breaking the rule for something we bought? We bought the player. We bought the disc. How can people accept that you're being told you're not allowed to watch this because somebody decided it? It's completely unfair. Whether it's hardware, whether it's software, you should have the ability to configure it to your liking. Whether it's wanting to see the credits at the end of Netflix, oh my God, that drives me crazy, where they put it into a little tiny thing and you have to do all these clicks to get it to fill up the screen so you can read the credits like you're supposed to be able to do. And by that time, the credits have already gone by, so you have to rewind in order to get to the part you missed. I'm sorry. I'll sit down. But man, that really bothers me.
You have trauma.
Well, it used to work. It used to, and the thing is, on older TVs, it still does.
Well, it's true. The developers, the companies that are maintaining, if at all, a lot of this stuff, they're fixing things. They often fix things in ways that aren't actually what you want. But they fixed it. They did something.
They did something. Yeah,
and it's very. No, all too common.
They make up their mind as to what they think it should work, and maybe for them it does, but not for me.
Yeah.
Give me that option. Yep. And this goes for every bit of software, every bit of hardware. People should have this ability to do this.
If you have a funny experience about a particular device or working with something like this, do write us a letter. We'd love to share your story.
Well, I don't have time to write a letter, but I can tell you about something right now on the air if you want. I had a funny experience with a television set. It involved a tornado last week. There was a tornado out on Long Island. It's really kind of cool. And a water spout. All sorts of fun out there. So there was an emergency alert that went out over the radio stations and the TV stations and things like that. Now, my cable system, which is run by a company called Altice now, which is formerly known as Optimum, formerly known as Cablevision. I don't know. They have naming identity issues. They have a new feature, and we've talked about this, where they send a blue screen that basically tells you there's some kind of emergency going on.
It's like teletext.
A little bit.
It's like a text.
And at first it'll tell you what the emergency is, and then it'll just tell you that there's an emergency alert, and it'll say something like LI-all, which means all of Long Island.
Right.
So we had the situation where there was a tornado warning. A tornado was touching down out east. So, you know, you tune to their news station, which is News 12, and you want to hear the details. And you hear maybe about 10 seconds of it. Then the blue screen comes back and blocks it all out. Yeah, because they're alerting you that there's an emergency. And you're trying to hear about the emergency. So you have to turn the cable box off and turn it on again to get rid of the blue screen. And then the same thing keeps happening over and over again. So you can't get the information because they're too busy telling you that there's an emergency. Who thinks of these things? For God's sake, people. What are you doing? This is not how it's supposed to be working at all. It's great that you can send the blue screen to everybody and tell them there's an emergency, but you're kind of preventing them from hearing the details, which is very important.
Yeah, there's so much idealizing, I think, and that field testing is critical. People really, they have to, and listen to feedback. You have to listen to the consumers, the people that are using the stuff, and really take feedback seriously so that you're not putting out crap.
Uh-huh. I got feedback. I got feedback from somebody. I tweeted about this, and someone said that, yeah, this is the system that we have to keep you safe. Yeah, it keep me safe from getting information. That's not what I want. Anyway, if you have similar issues or complaints or anything you'd like to share with us, you can always write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear your stories. And you can call us. In fact, we'll be taking phone calls in just a little bit, 212-209-2877.
Yeah.
And what, tweet at us?
Yes.
Okay, it sounds violent, but go ahead, tweet at us.
At Hacker Radio Show.
Yes.
Hacker Radio Show.
Hacker Radio Show on Twitter.
Yeah.
And maybe you design or develop some of this garbage. Please, tell us how the sausage is made. We want to know how few dams you give.
You know what? Write an article for 2600, too, because that is always good. That gets out to so many people, and it's forever. And we love to hear about how things work from within. So if you have access to information like that, no matter what it is, it's always relevant. If it involves a system of any sort, you know, a train system, a computer system, an emergency alert system, whatever, there are people who are interested in that, and we are those people. So please check out our webpage, 2600.com. There's information on how to send articles in there. You will have an audience for a long, long time that will be very fascinated by this. Plus, you'll be educating people on how certain things work, because we don't always get it right. That's for sure.
We're not experts.
No, we don't claim to be.
Never did.
And you know who else is not experts? The Department of Homeland Security. This doesn't surprise me. It shouldn't surprise anybody. They stored sensitive data from the nation's bioterrorism defense program on an insecure website where it was vulnerable to attacks by hackers for over a decade. It wasn't vulnerable to attacks by anyone else, just by hackers. They were the only threat. Terrorists or criminals or just plain outright thieves or whatever. No, hackers are the ones you have to be afraid of. You know, hackers probably were the ones who revealed this. Wouldn't be surprised. The data included locations of at least some BioWatch air samplers, which are installed at subway stations and other public locations in more than 30 U.S. cities. They're designed to detect anthrax or other airborne biological weapons. You need a website for that? I can tell you where those are. They're right there. You can see them. It also included the results of tests for possible pathogens, a list of biological agents that could be detected, and response plans that would be put in place in the event of an attack. Now, this information was housed on a .org website run by a private contractor. It's been moved behind a secure federal government firewall, and the website was shut down back in May. But Homeland Security officials acknowledge they do not know whether hackers ever gained access to the data. And we're not going to tell them, are we?
No.
Yeah. If you're going to demonize us like this, yeah, okay, we have all the information.
We do.
Yeah, we have access to everything. So
we know all about it.
Yeah. Internal Homeland Security emails and other documents, which somehow these people at the LA Times have gotten their hands on, they set off a bitter clash within the department over whether keeping the information on the .org website posed a threat to national security. A former BioWatch security manager filed a whistleblower complaint alleging he was targeted for retaliation after criticizing the program's lax security. Your problem is not hackers. Your problem is you don't know what you're doing. Your problem is that you take action against people that reveal the truth.
Yeah, you're not listening to your own people.
You're not listening. You're not learning. Website shared information among local, state, and federal officials. It was easily identifiable through online search engines, but a username and password were required to access sensitive data. But I'll bet that was pretty easy to get as well. A security audit completed in January of 2017 found critical and high-risk vulnerabilities, including weak encryption that made the website extremely prone to online attacks. The audit concluded that there does not seem to be any protective monitoring of the site. And that's according to a Homeland Security report summarizing the findings. So, but they keep going back to this. Was it vulnerable to hackers? And that's not the point. The point is that you put all this stuff out there. Who did that? Who is responsible? Who is making these bad decisions? Are they learning anything? Because we're all hoping they are.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm always banging on about on this program is that responsible security disclosure is a thing, but it's also a fact of it that when you find a vulnerability somewhere, you never assume you were the first idiot smart enough to find that vulnerability. You assume other people have found it before you or will find it after you if it's not been fixed. This is a fact of information security.
And the reason why you should always reveal information when you find it, whether it's publicly or whether it's leaking it to newspapers or magazines, basically, if you don't do that, the security hole is still going to be there. And the next person who finds it might not be as nice as you. And they're probably not going to tell anybody, and they're probably going to use it in one way or another that really causes problems. So when you find something like this, yeah, I mean, I'm aware that when you reveal information, you're very often treated as if you created the problem in the first place. This happens everywhere from grade school all the way into the government. People, we just reported this. People are basically punished for revealing security holes. It happens all the time. So that's why you have to do it anonymously whenever possible. And just make sure it gets to the right people and make sure that you embarrass the right people as well, because they need to be embarrassed in order to do their job. That's very important. All right. And speaking of embarrassment, we all know that Jack Dorsey's Twitter account was hacked. Jack Dorsey, of course, is one of the founders. He's the CEO, in fact, of Twitter. And on Friday, he either turned into a racist bigot or somebody got a hold of his account. You know, if any of us were able to become Jack Dorsey, there are so many more important things we would say with that account than just tweeting out anti-Semitic and racist and ignorant things. But that is the mentality that we find ourselves in today. So everyone who watched the events, this is according to an article from Business Insider, everyone who watched the events seemed to have the same thought. If Twitter can't protect its CEO's account from hackers, and again, hackers are the issue here, how can it protect Donald Trump's account? I have a better question. How can you protect us from Donald Trump's account? I mean, how would we even know if his account was hacked? Seriously. There are so many times I've thought that, no, this can't be right. And it's 100% what he's saying. Maybe we shouldn't be taking Twitter so seriously. And by extension, the people who use Twitter to say things, maybe we shouldn't be assuming that that's coming from the best source in the first place. The headline to this story, it took Twitter longer to secure Jack Dorsey's account from hackers than it would for a nuclear missile to travel around the world. And that should terrify you. What terrifies me is people who take Twitter this seriously that they actually think that war can be started through a tweet.
I think you could.
You think what?
I think you could.
Well, no, it can. But that should terrify you, the fact that people are taking Twitter. So that is the problem. Not the fact that they couldn't secure it quickly enough.
But it's like a tautology. People are taking Twitter seriously because people take Twitter seriously. So you kind of have to live in that reality.
Why? Why can't we change that reality where people don't take Twitter seriously?
Well, one thing that's being done along those lines is the Mastodon project, which is the open source knockoff of Twitter. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in that, go to joinmastodon.org and check that out. And yeah, if you use it, you can add us at hackerradioshow@mastodon.social.
Do people take that as seriously as Twitter, though?
No, we're all still having fun with it over there. It's like the early days of Twitter when it was just a fun toy.
But I mean, we take it seriously in the sense that it like provides, it's useful and provides like joy and a way to communicate with your friends. And like that's, it communicate news. And I think that's a generally useful tool.
To think that a nuclear war could be started by Twitter.
But it could.
Okay, that to me is a disconnect from reality. How? Unless you believe everything you're told because it's on the internet.
But people do. Whenever.
Yeah, but that's the problem, is my point. That's the problem we should be focusing on. Not the fact that Jack Dorsey's Twitter account got hacked or that Twitter took too long to deal with it. The fact that we're believing things we're saying, we're hearing, we're reading all the time on the internet.
But how is saying on the internet any different than 200 years ago? Like, in books,
it's harder
it's just
to
a new. It's just a new field of foreign communication.
Well, we didn't have a nuclear war 200 years ago, and books took a while to publish. It's a kind of a different universe, but you should always question whatever you're told. That's a very important thing, and I think people are doing that a lot less and just assuming what they're reading is true all the time. And that's kind of how we've gotten to the state we're in right now.
Yeah, like there was always in the old days of the public-facing internet, there were people who took things like IRC drama too seriously in real life, and I think what we're seeing now is the modern iteration of that.
Yeah, have you ever heard the phrase, it's only IRC? I've said that to people so many times, and they're like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to calm down a little bit, and you know, but people just overreact to things that don't matter, and yeah, it's true that we have a president that takes Twitter super seriously. Doesn't mean we have to. We can ignore the things he says and not believe them as much and just focus on the things he does and the things that he is actually standing in front of microphones and spouting forth. But Twitter, yeah, I'm not saying let him off the hook, but let's not start wars based on something like this. That's insane. And to believe that's possible, I think, you know, that's the real problem we need to focus on.
But we've seen like concrete examples of this, like stocks can get crashed if communicated tweets happen.
Yeah, all you're doing is proving my point that people are taking it too seriously and bad things happen as a result. Well, yeah. What do you think? Okay, I'm curious. What do you think should happen to the person who hacked Jack Dorsey's account? Or let's say a person hacked Donald Trump's account and, you know, said the same things, although people would probably believe it was him anyway. But what should happen? What is the penalty for hacking a Twitter account?
I'm more concerned with Twitter, the company, for having such lax security practices.
Exactly. That is the issue.
Yeah.
You know, but not because our physical security is at risk.
But it is at risk.
It shouldn't be.
I think it is because so many corporations and serious bureaucratic entities are using it as an official communications channel, mm-hmm. whereas in the past they would have put forth an official press release, something that would have a contact person in the communications office, someone that if you wanted to verify that press release, you could contact them directly, tell them what, you know, you're trying to figure out about it, or you know, otherwise verify where it's coming from. This stuff's way easier to fake, like taking over someone's account or putting forth something that appears a certain way because people aren't giving it the same scrutiny. It doesn't have the same weight when it comes from a Twitter account, even though it's verified or whatever credential we want to attribute to something on that platform. It just, it's not the same to me. And I think that's, it's an effect of this sort of individual sort of fun and joy you're talking about, combining and being mixed in with the very serious, like, corporate branding side or the corporate communications side or, you know, governments, right, representatives using it. It's colloquial and folksy and, you know, yeah, brings us joy and stuff, but it's also it's being used for things that otherwise would not have the same level of interaction, would not have the same projection, right, and the ability to move around on that platform in the same way. And that speed, that I think is why we're a little bit terrified that yes, a war or something could start, because it you know, if NORAD said something and the president said something and some government we hate said something, it might be enough there.
And
you
it's
know?
All based on tweets and things like that. Look, back then you had bona fide news sources. Like Kyle said, you could verify, you could contact somebody. Today, anything is a source. Today, anybody is a journalist, and you don't have that verification. So that means misinformation can spread so much quicker and faster. And if we take it all seriously, we're going to pay the price for that.
Just letterhead. I know you've messed around with letterhead in your day, but like an official press release coming on letterhead from an organization and having a point of contact and having, you know, that ability to verify, right? I think that's where authentication and security is kind of a stand-in, but it's not working. And I think that's your point.
Yeah.
And when it's broken, you need to point out how it's broken and how to fix it. And I think that's what they need to do here. But I just want to read this last couple of paragraphs from this story, again, from Business Insider. In total, 21 minutes elapsed before the company was even able to confirm that its CEO's account had been hacked at 2:22 p.m. Pacific time. 1 hour and 36 minutes after the first hacked tweet hit the ether, Twitter pronounced Dorsey's account secure. How long would it take a nuclear-tipped missile to travel from North Korea to the U.S.? In 37 minutes, a North Korean missile could reach Honolulu. It would take only 41 minutes to reach Washington, D.C. Yeah, Trump is right. Twitter is like a rocket, and we've now had two very clear warnings that the company is not up to the task of handling such a serious responsibility. I had to read this three times to make sure that that was a serious statement. But they actually believe that Twitter is so serious that, you know, somebody who is hacking accounts is actually putting us in physical jeopardy. And I think there's, you know, that's a real reality check we have to all undergo before we take something like that seriously.
No, I think the tragedy is that it's incredibly silly, but it is the reality we live in. So they have to keep it secure. Like
if it's incredibly silly, say, why are we living in an incredibly silly reality? We need to change.
It's called
that.
Capitalism.
Well, you know, there are people working to fix that and to just make it something a bit more serious and logical.
And let's be specific, you know, like for the sake of it, for the sake of the discussion and the issues at hand, you know, let's be deliberate in how we're looking at it, because it is important. And I mean, yeah, there are attributes that are silly, but it's deadly serious as well. So
yeah, we've always to a degree lived in a very silly reality, but there are aspects of the reality now that everyone is still figuring out what the hell to do with. One of them is the fact that, like, in the old days, even when a president wanted to get out there and say something, there would be like an announcement crafted, and it would go through other people before it reached the public on that letterhead. And now we have we have presidential thoughts being tweeted directly from the toilet or whatever, and we're all absorbing things directly in that manner, and none of us know what the hell to do with this media environment that we've got. None of us know how to pick through these things or deal with it in a healthy manner.
I just want to say, I would say there probably would be a distinction there between that leadership and how that platform is being used by that particular leader and sort of the rest of, I think, what we're pointing out about society and how this mix of individual thoughts and opinions is going along with, you know, corporate or you know, businesses and those entities and governments and how they present on these platforms. And, you know, I think that is a very unique, crazy scenario that we're experiencing and living through. And, right, I mean, who's going to tell the president that he's using Twitter wrong or, like, he needs to change it? Okay. I mean, that's just not something that I think people feel is, like, accessible.
The thing is, you know, I want to be able to say that if you have the ability to get into Trump's Twitter account, if it's that insecure, you should do it. You should do it and prove how insecure it is. But we should not all have to pay the price with our lives because people take Twitter too seriously. And I should not get in trouble for telling people that, yeah, if you can get into Trump's Twitter account, you should, because we all need to see how ridiculous it is to treat a platform like that, like it's the final word on anything. Like Rob said, we're all bad at this. We're all learning as we go along. And there's a comfort in that. There's a comfort in knowing that we're all stumbling through this technology and learning ways to use it properly.
That's a really good point. It is emerging, and like we need to remind ourselves that 5-10 years in, this is still very new, and especially the way it's being used. It's like we can have it for 5 years and people have not yet quite figured out the power and how to leverage it. Now people have entire departments, people are working on this in a very mature, you know, it's reached a point of saturation in society, so that it is new, but there's new ways of using it. I think that we're also still learning, very, very much so.
Yeah, I think, to your point, it takes time to get used to these things. Yes, it's new and it happens a lot faster, but also, like, in the 1940s and stuff, like, the King and Queen of England, it would never go on the TV or the radio because that was considered not posh enough. And it's novel when they went on for the first time. Now we have, when Obama first was first president to get, I assume, when he got a Twitter account, people thought that was like very novel and like maybe unpresidential.
But it was wholly like curated to every letter, and it was, probably.
So you're saying that Trump being on Twitter is Obama's fault?
No, not at all.
No, I think it is actually. But, wow.
But look at the distinction of how it's being used, right? He had probably entire teams helping him craft every single one, or at least checking, to make sure it's looking.
I think Obama could craft a tweet on his own.
All right, but is it on brand? Is it, is it his, something that...
He becomes the brand. He defines... I'm not going to get into that.
All I'm saying is that after this, if Trump ever leaves...
There's no
right,
after this.
there will be a vacuum of how Twitter is not being used that way, because I don't think any of the alternatives, were they to take that position, I don't think they'll use it nearly in the same way, perhaps more so than Obama, and maybe less filtered than what I'm saying I think Obama's account may have been, but I don't know that. I'm just throwing that out there as a hypothetical that, yeah, it's we're going to notice less of that, as I said, unique leader if he ever leaves. But it is still going to be a new platform that is used in a way that had not been in previous administrations.
You're listening to Off the Hook here on WBAI in New York. Come join the conversation. Call us 212-209-2877. We are live on the radio here in New York. If you're interested in exactly how the CEO of Twitter's account was hacked, according to Wired, it was a so-called SIM swap attack with a particular focus on AT&T. And a SIM swap, and here's Wired buying into it as well, a hacker, because only a hacker will do this, either convinces or bribes a carrier employee to switch the number associated with a SIM card to another device, at which point they can intercept any two-factor authentication codes sent by text message. It's hard to stop a determined SIM swapper, but at the very least, you should switch from SMS two-factor to an authenticator app. So that apparently is how that particular hack was done.
SMS two-factor was not working. So the guy, the attacker woman, calls and says,
"That's better.
Hi, I just lost my phone and I bought another one and I just got a SIM from a retail location. Hey, can you just go ahead and update it so that I don't have to blah, 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 blah?" And then the person on the phone says, "Well, okay, can you give me this? Can you give me that? Yeah, da, 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 da. Yeah, okay, you're that person. And now what do you want to do again? Okay, yeah, so basically I lost my phone, I flushed it down the toilet, and I have a SIM card that a friend gave me. Here's the IMEI," or whatever the number on the SIM card is.
Right.
Can you go ahead and change that? I'm actually getting on a bus right now, blah, 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 da, 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 da. And then all of a sudden, I'm Jack Dorsey.
I had you connected to AT&T while you were saying all that, and they've done it again.
Oh.
Yeah, it's that easy. It's that easy. Voltaire.
Yeah, and this gets back to why we should be blaming Twitter for this and not the individual attacker, because there's just multi-factor authentication system. It makes it extremely difficult not to fall back to SMS, and which is much less secure than with a authentication app.
So. Wow. So SMS 2FA is no longer adequate given this.
I'd say
scenario.
It's better than nothing,
right?
But
they're encouraging this third-party software to help protect the authentication.
No, I'm saying they should be encouraging like a third-party software as opposed to like something like.
Oh,
Google.
And they're not.
Yeah,
okay. They're okay. Encouraging I thought that was a guidance that they had released as a part of what E was reading.
But yeah, it's easy to hang all this on Twitter right now. But I think in the larger scheme of things, you know, Twitter as a service, as a company, may not be around forever. Eventually, something else will take over. You know, we've been through so many. We used to go through so many waves of like whatever the cool social network was to be on at the time, and then Facebook and Twitter sort of just stayed there, and people haven't. The general public hasn't moved on to anything else yet, but maybe one day they will. And so I think it's better to think about this in a more distant sort of way and just reexamine how we depend on all of these social media pieces of guff and how, you know, its place in our lives and how much we're actually hanging on it, how much importance we're actually ascribing to it.
How easy it is to do something that is fake. And compare that to things in the past, how easy it is to do things fake there. And always have some doubt in your mind as to whether or not you're being told the truth. If you do that, you know, have some cynicism. I think you won't fall for these things quite as easily.
Yeah, critical thinking at every turn when you're using something that's new, like for instance, or something doesn't seem right. Definitely give it a second look. It never hurts to analyze things in that way. So when did Trump switch to an iPhone?
What?
Didn't he start out on an Android phone? And is he on an iPhone
You
now?
Look at me like I would care about this or
I don't
pay
know.
Attention to it.
Well, I'm wondering if that was in the story. Forget it. You know what? It's not that important.
Well, he's not using a BlackBerry. That much I do know.
Okay, good.
212-209-2877. I don't know if we're intimidating people. We're not technical experts on any of this. These are our opinions. We want to hear your opinions. So don't be intimidated if we're talking too much technology. That's just our nature sometimes. 212-209-2877. Call from anywhere. We'd love to hear your opinions. Now, apparently in Spokane, they're planning to keep their computers hack-free. Yeah, good luck with that. When parents sign up their kids for school, they never imagine that private family information could be exposed as easily as a teacher clicking on a virus. This week in Long Island? Okay, I don't know how this relates to Spokane. This week in Long Island, the school district was forced to pay $88,000 in ransom after a hacker... Again, threatened to release student and staff information. Always a hacker.
Is the newspaper or the publication you're reading, is that from Spokane?
The website is khq.com. I don't know if that's what?
If it has a K, it's on the West Coast. So.
Yeah,
it could also just be three letters. You don't know it's even a TV station. This is what I mean. You know, I'm reading this, and it could be completely fake. You don't know.
That's like deja vu for 2015.
Louisiana is under a state of emergency after several of their school systems were also hacked. Both of these districts had been using antivirus software. And here in Spokane, public schools say they've been doing their homework about this. We're certainly watching the national trends and what's been happening around the country. It's a constant area of improvement for us, and we'll continue to be vigilant with it, says Brian Coddington of Spokane Public Schools. Coddington says the district monitors threats every day and haven't experienced problems like other schools around the country. The Spokane Public Schools website was built in-house, which they feel is safer from being hacked, and the same goes for their school's app as they've used third-party vendors. Part of our process in selecting vendors is making sure they've taken the necessary steps to be protective of our family's information. How is this a story? All they're doing is saying we haven't gotten hacked yet and we're better than everybody else, and... Wow, you see, I kind of fell for it here. I read the story, and it's really just a bunch of bravado. Okay, well, Spokane Public Schools, we'll see how good you are. It's not like I'm saying that people should go out there and... Oh, am I pronouncing it wrong, Kyle?
Yes, it's Spokane.
Yeah, you're from Washington. Okay, but
that has nothing to do with it.
All right, fine. I can't even pronounce the city right. Spokane. Okay. We have a caller, 212-209-2877. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. Can you guys hear me?
We hear you fine.
Perfect. I hate to always be one for like advertising an awesome hacker-related event coming up, but I feel like this is a good venue for that.
It is a hacker radio show, so go ahead.
Just letting everyone know that there's going to be an event this Saturday. That's September 7th, starting at 8 p.m. at DROM. That's at 85th Avenue A in Manhattan. It's called Hustler's Paradise. And what it is a bunch of sex workers who are fed up with the censorship of the internet and Sesta Fosta are making a pop-up strip club, and all the money that's going to be raised during this pop-up strip club is going to be donated to the EFF to fight online censorship, promote privacy, and to fight Sesta Fosta for their worker rights. I just wanted to let everyone know that event's coming up because, unfortunately, they don't have a website for it besides DROM's own website, and I feel like it's not really been promoted that much, so I'm just trying to spread the word to fight internet censorship.
Well, that's great. We wish you luck, and urge people to check that out. That sounds really awesome.
Yeah, interesting concept.
Is there a specific organization that's running it?
Yeah, do they have any contact info for the production?
Unfortunately, I mean, besides two of the people at the EFF, that's been one of the problems is the lack of promotion for this. I know it's the thing is, it's more of a bunch of different, like, different independent sex workers that all each other got together and did this, so there's no organization, unfortunately.
Okay,
they are doing this.
Sure, go ahead. What's the name?
It's going to be called Hustler's Paradise, and I'm pretty sure if you type that in and type DROM, which is DROM for New York, it's in their website. The URL is ridiculously long for the event, but that's the only event page.
Okay, and this is, again, when?
This is happening this Saturday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing the information.
Thank you.
All right. And our phone lines are open, 212-209-2877. See how easy that was? All you have to do is give a call and say whatever is on your mind, and we'll be a receptive audience.
It's also great hearing about groups like this that get together with a common goal to actually change some of the bad decisions and some of the other situations in which we find ourselves. And people doing what they do for a living, but for a good cause, is just always warms my heart.
And representation matters. Absolutely. And you got to represent for a cause. That's I think important and inspiring.
Absolutely. Here's a phone call. Let's see who is on the other end of this one. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to make a comment about a discussion you were having last week about Brexit.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think they should have ever given him that choice. David Cameron, who was the prime minister during that time, 2016, I think it was, he's the one who put up that referendum back then.
Right.
But I don't think he should have ever done it. I mean, he did it because it was an election promise. He promised during the election, if you elect me, I would do this. I would offer this referendum.
Mm-hmm.
But he shouldn't have done it. I mean, people make election promises all the time and don't fulfill them. He should have just forgot about it, because now this is what has caused this quagmire they're in. I don't think they should have ever done it. And then Theresa May, who came in after him, everything she did as far as the negotiations, she did everything wrong. I mean, she was a good person, but she did everything wrong. And in my opinion, it's at this point, it's very difficult for this guy, Boris Johnson, to go back right now and try to renegotiate that deal that she already did. And I actually like Boris Johnson. I think he's a good guy. I think what's going on now, I think I'm actually following this thing. I find it just fascinating. I'm not from the UK. I don't know anything. I just find this particular thing fascinating. But I think he's a good guy, and I think if they actually give him a chance, I think he can get something done. And what he's doing now, to me, I think is the right stance, which is we're going to leave 31st anyway. In other words, hold the EU feet to the fire. And I just think it's a bluff. I think he's just bluffing. I don't think he plans to leave on the 31st without a deal. I think he's just bluffing.
Well, he can't leave now. He's lost three major votes, including a vote to have an election in October. You know, what I'm encouraged by, I wasn't so encouraged last week. I'm encouraged this week because I'm seeing democracy in action in England in ways that it does not seem to happen here, where basically people from someone's own party actually have the guts to stand up and question and criticize. They paid the price. Yeah, he sacked them from the party, but they did the right thing. And as a result, it's not going towards that cliff that everybody said it was going towards on October 31st. It might be January 31st. There might be another referendum. I disagree. I think that people should have another say in this because they've learned so much about what Brexit actually means. And now that they know this, we should ask, or they should ask, are you sure this is what you want to go through with?
I agree. There should be another referendum. That's the right way right now.
Okay, well, then let's agree on that. And hopefully sanity will prevail. I think, if they get through that, it'll be a tremendous inspiration to all the other countries in the world that are going through crises of one sort or another.
I love your show, by the way.
And thank you for calling.
All right, thanks.
We're going to take, it's not that funny, but we're going to take one other phone call. Yeah. But first, Kyle, you have something to say?
No, I just want to say stay curious, and it's cool that you're following it. That's it's an interesting system, and we like systems and like learning about them.
Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi. I'm calling you from way out here behind Bedminster in Hunterdon County, and I just want to say something that may strike you as totally off the wall.
Okay.
But as we're dealing with an off-the-wall president who wants to, make sure that you're crazy enough to, join one organization but not the other. How about, as the NRA is a profit-making organization, maybe they should come out with their own credit card. And when anybody comes in and buys an excess of MO, that not only do they get a picture of them, they get the tag of the vehicle, and then we would have a much better control. You don't lose money with credit card companies. You will lose people down the booby hatch because their medication is not up to Donnie's standards. Am I making sense?
A little bit. I'd kind of like to steer in a direction where so much ammo isn't being sold in the first place.
Yeah, but the thing is this. If you know where it went,
But how do you know it wasn't given to somebody else? I mean, this latest mass shooter got the gun he wasn't allowed to get because somebody gave it to him, and apparently that's not illegal.
Well, here's another thing I want to say. It's certainly great to surveil the whole damn country, which is virtually impossible, and you know it'll be used for political purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is it so strange that when people are buying masses of stuff that we start looking at them before they get to where they got?
Right. If we look at people for various other reasons, it seems like this should be one of them that we look at people. But is that the answer? Is that the road we want to go down? We need to have the conversation.
No, not necessarily. But we've got people in the government who believe that, you didn't take your Ritalin this morning. We're going to come out and get you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's not the right road to go down, obviously.
Yeah. But as I say, we've got the NRA, makes millions of dollars a year. They could actually set up an insurance fund for some of the victims, and also the municipalities have to clean up these messes.
Right.
You don't just walk into Walmart and just with a wet mop and start to clean up things. It costs money to murder people.
I think it's going to take a lot more pressure for them to take responsibility and do so in such a way that they institute a program or, like you said, devise their own credit card that has some sort of verification or tie-in with a gun ownership registry of some sort, but that's also the same group and I dare I say a social group that is going to look at any kind of list like that in much the same way we do as far as privacy goes.
Let's close with the last words of the caller. It costs money to murder people. I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you for the call.
Okay, and have a good night. Thank you for being there.
And you can write to us, oth@2600.com. And Rob, yes, you seem to have something to say.
I do. 2600 meetings happen all over the world this weekend.
Not
2600.
Again. Really?
.com/meetings.
First Friday of every month, huh?
First Friday of every month, unless you're in Israel and it's Thursday.
That's right. You can't stop it. All right. Well, we'll be back next week talking about other things as well. Again, write to us, oth@2600.com, and stay tuned to WBAI. Good night.
Melt the guns.
2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Welcome to The Cutting Edge, where journalism, culture, politics, and activism converge. I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Good old days were full of sunshine. Now they're full of rain. The sun's passing right and warm.
The Young Lords Party celebrated its 50th anniversary at the Schomburg Library for research in Black culture. And that venue, founded by the Black Puerto Rican Arturo Schomburg, influenced by the Black Panther Party in both its organization and political platform, the Young Lords represented the continuing resistance against colonial and domestic oppression. Tonight, The Cutting Edge presents excerpts from that joyful reunion celebration, and Professor Johanna Fernandez and former Young Lords Party members Gloria Rodriguez and Alina Serrano welcome the audience and remember fallen Young Lords members.
Mariana Bracetti. Julia de Burgos. Ibisu Campos. Presente. Blanca Canales. Presente. Luisa Capetillo. Presente. Fidel Castro. Presente. Camilo Cienfuegos. Presente. Che Guevara. Presente. Fred Hampton. Presente. Marsha P. Johnson. Presente. Dr. Martin Luther King. Presente. Lolita Lebron. Presente. Sylvia Rivera. Presente. Lola Rodriguez de Tio. Presente. Celia Sanchez. Presente. Arturo Schomburg. Presente. Mama Tingo. Presente. Malcolm X. Presente. I'll go ahead and read a list of contemporary ancestors and Young Lords Party's supporters. Richard Perez. We'll get there.
We'll get there.
Doctora Evelina Lopez Antonetti. Victor Feliciano. Reverend Bruce Johnson. Eugenia Rancier Johnson.
We can overcome everything.
Dr. Steve Levine.
All that suffering.
Linda Malave.
We can overcome everything.
Andrew McInerney.
All that suffering. We can overcome.
Really?
suffering. We can overcome everything. All that suffering. We can overcome everything. All that suffering. I can overcome everything.
Johanna Fernandez, and I'm a professor of history at Baruch College of the City University of New York. I am part of the very hardworking committee that has put this event together. Before I start, I would like to thank for their gracious support Casey Matthews, the person you heard from just a minute ago, who's the head of staff here at the Schomburg. We'd also like to thank Aisha Diore and Rio Cortez for all of their work. They invited us, welcomed us graciously, and said that yes, they would host an event on the 50th anniversary of the Young Lord. So we'd like to thank certainly the house that Arturo Alfonso Schomburg built and the current staff at the Schomburg Center for Black Culture. Please. These are the folks who are keeping alive the radical tradition in Harlem. I'd like to start by saying that the wave of protest that unseated Ricardo Rosselló that unseated Ricardo Rosselló is giving this quote by Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin a run for its money. Quote, there are decades when nothing happens. There are weeks when decades happen. Unquote. In the case of Puerto Rican resistance, change happened in days, not weeks. And protests happen in endlessly creative ways, on horseback, by jet ski, paddleboarding, scuba diving, skydiving, through motorcade, y hasta perreo en la fortaleza. And even a twerking battalion in front of the governor's mansion. All of this is a reflection of the unforgiving crisis Puerto Ricans have suffered in the time of Maria under colonial rule. 50 years ago here in Chicago and in New York, over there in Chicago and New York, on this day, July 26, 1969, a generation of socialist youth made it their top priority to expose U.S. imperialism on the island of Borinquen. They set their sights on Puerto Rican independence and freedom for everyone everywhere. The story of the Young Lords is intoxicating for many reasons, because it resonates with the suffering and aspirations of millions of young people who are outsiders in America today. Like the children of NAFTA, who migrated from Mexico and other parts of the Caribbean and Latin America over the past two decades, the Young Lords underwent the crucible of migration as children. They were the sons and daughters of a vast migration from Puerto Rico to cities like New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia. The Young Lords inspired their generation and inspire today because they gave their generation the language and analysis to make sense of the trauma produced by the large-scale economic and social forces that massively displaced their parents from their homeland. A decade ago, two decades ago, it was NAFTA. 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, it was Operation Bootstrap. Like migrants today, Puerto Ricans were blamed for the problems of American society. They were depicted as knife-wielding criminals and junkies on the one hand, and as mild-mannered people who could be pushed around on the other. But the Young Lords and others of their generation changed that perception. Their intrepid organizing campaigns, literature, bold political analysis and media savvy, and their militancy in the streets changed history, because social movements change history. They reclaimed, give it up, social movements change history. That's what we're seeing in Puerto Rico. They reclaimed the dignity of New York's hardest working and most exploited workers and replaced stereotypes of Puerto Ricans with powerful images of radical, strategic, and articulate militancy by young Puerto Ricans. As Barry Goddard, who was the mayor's man, member of the mayoral administration, told me in an interview, the Young Lords couldn't be placated with anti-poverty money, and you couldn't mess with them either. They took over a church and a hospital and made out like bandits on the evening news. They exposed police brutality and fought police repression in the streets. They believed that human rights are most important when we are most vulnerable and most human, when we are sick. And so they demanded free health care for all. They drafted the first patient bill of rights with hospital workers and medical staff at Lincoln Hospital. Young Lord militancy is credited for pressuring City Hall here in New York to finally pass New York's anti-lead poisoning legislation in the early 1970s. They formed part of the era's prisoners' rights movement, exposed imprisonment as a tool of repression against radicals, the poor, the black and the brown, and their militancy led to the first ever formal investigation of the death of a young lord at the Tombs, the infamous jail here in New York. But ultimately, we remember the Young Lords because a gang in Chicago was daring, courageous, and principled enough to stand with the most persecuted radicals of their time, the Black Panther Party. I'd like to acknowledge all of the political prisoners who are here in the House, Laura Whitehorn, Susan Rosenberg, Brother Tariq, and there are many others. The Young Lords and the people of their generation sacrificed everything for justice and freedom, and they fought for the highest aspirations of humanity, and for that, we thank them. I bring to you the Puerto Rican poet, Jenny Rose.
There was some stuff up here, now that's not. There was some papers up here. Yeah. Anybody know where they went? Eso, mijo. Vaya, mi gente, ¿cómo están? Sí, no, I was edited and all kinds of stuff. All right. Ah, pues, él quiere que... He wants the whole poem, I said. We got to figure that out. That's a 10-minute poem. Me van a sacar con with the... All right, mommy, thank you.